Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Michael Morris. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about the state of the Government of National Unity and how apparently President Ramaphosa is not even meeting with his coalition partners. We're also going to talk a little bit about happy, clappy, talking up South Africa, even when it has very real problems, and why that's a bad idea. And lastly, we're going to be talking a little bit about the staggering sums of money that were stolen from Tembisa Hospital. So let's get into our first story. According to reporting in News 24, Cyril Ramaphosa last met the Government of National Unity party leaders from the parties other than the ANC 143 days ago, despite regularly promising them regular engagement. John Steenhuisen says the president doesn't want to meet coalition partners, can't even schedule 20-minute meetings with him, the leader of the largest party in the coalition. According to leaders of the DA, the Freedom Front Plus, Rise Mzansi, and Good, they say that more frequent meetings would enable them to forge a common program of government and better coordinate cooperation in cabinet and parliament. Especially Rise Mzansi has also complained that everyone in the coalition has a separate agreement with the ANC, and so they feel like there's no kind of common coalition agreement. John Steenhuisen says that he promised there would be a Bosporat or a Lekgotla for party leaders and we could get to know one another better, but nothing has come of it. He says that he's been trying to get Ramaphosa to appoint a replacement for Deputy Trade and Industry Minister Andrew Whitfield, who was fired by Ramaphosa in June. But he cannot get a meeting with Ramaphosa to approve the replacement. Steenhuisen said, quote, "It is his prerogative who should serve in the executive, so I'd obviously want to clear it with him first rather than just announce a name." Corne Milder from the Freedom Front Plus says that he had been struggling since July to get access to Ramaphosa after he visited the United States and after meeting with people in the U.S. government. He tried to get a meeting with Ramaphosa to talk about what he had heard there and was told to contact the Department of Trade and Industry. If there was a better example of how the GNU is in reality the government of not really national unity, I think this is it. It's also why, you know, it has really not achieved many of the goals that some of the more optimistic hope that it might be able to achieve. There's no sort of desire to govern as a coalition. Each department seems to be its kind of own island, doing its own thing as far as it can. So you've got some non-ANC ministers and some ANC ministers, and they're all off doing their own thing. They only talk within their own parties. This kind of feels almost a little bit more like a supply and confidence agreement, where the parties have agreed to sort of put an executive together, but not really on any kind of government plan of action. What's your take on all of this?
I mean, there's some quite telling observations here by the reporter, City Press reporter Davi Buenzaya, where he mentions that Steenhuisen has said that his proposal for a so-called whiskey caucus between him and Ramaphosa to improve their relationship has borne no fruit. And then he mentions from Mandy Wiener's book, The Deal, that the complaint by Ramaphosa that unfortunately there's no magic between him and Steenhuisen, the DA leader. And, you know, you immediately think, well, if you're waiting for magic to emerge in politics, you're really not in the right game. I mean, it's a question of making the magic. It's a question of, in fact, overlooking the idea that there needs to be magic. You've got to get things done, and you get along with people that you make an effort to get along with. That's true of life, I think, as much as politics or any other sort of field of activity. And if you're simply not making the effort, well, there's no prospect of either a whiskey caucus or any kind of magic, liquid assistance or not. And it does speak, as you say, very much to the attitude of the ANC. It's the apparent attitude that it doesn't have to get on with its partners. And sort of seeming obliviousness to the very notion that they're now in a coalition. They're not governing on their own. It's as if they're blind to this really quite harsh reality. Something we were chatting about before the show, the research by the Social Research Foundation about the public's attitude to the GNU and so on. The very great risk that the ANC surely faces is that the public will associate any failure of the GNU as a kind of functional government that can potentially make things better for the country. They will associate that failure with the ANC, not with the other participant parties. And this kind of story really brings out why that is so, and why the ANC itself should be taking this much more seriously. That it, you know, as our CEO John Endres has pointed out just quite recently, the ANC has the most to gain actually from making the GNU work, from making it a vehicle for reform that does actually change lives, change the policy landscape, increase the scope for investment, for growth, for job creation, and all those things begin to see some kind of uptick. It'll be, you know, the parties in the Government of National Unity and expressly the ANC who stand to benefit. So it really is quite a striking instance of its a kind of failure of perception of the moment that it's now being presented with.
It's also interesting in how I think this really does reveal the just kind of shocking level of the lack of leadership that Ramaphosa has provided. My greatest fear, actually, with the formation of the GNU would be that the DA and some of the other opposition parties would essentially kind of just be co-opted into the ANC's program of doing things. And, you know, there were some worries about that in the beginning when there was questions about whether the DA was ever going to be able to kind of get its way in these things, or whether it was just going to be stuck implementing ANC's policies. And that hasn't happened. And I think a large part of why that's happened is actually because Ramaphosa has played his card so badly, even from the sort of ANC perspective, which is that he's just sort of tried to not engage. He's kind of almost just, he's let the thing run down the hill and, you know, almost just kind of hoping that it'll end up in the right place. And so what we've got is this sort of bizarre cold war in government, where you have all these different departments, and everyone knows that we're just waiting for two things. One is the local government elections, where of course the ANC and DA are going to battle all over the country for control of the country's metros, and two, for the ANC's elective conference, where a new faction may come to power and the GNU may be over, and then there may be some sort of MK-EFF-ANC coalition. So, you know, we're kind of in this sort of bizarre holding pattern. And I think, you know, Ramaphosa has, since his election as ANC leader in 2017, has shown that he is just really one of the most overhyped political talents, I think, in South African history. He's only passed the policies that, unless you measure it by the barometer of passing some of the ANC's most radical policies, which I suppose he's done. But even then, he doesn't seem to have done it with enough skill to actually gain anything politically from it. The passage of NHI, the expropriation bill into the Expropriation Act, none of these have rebounded to the ANC's effort. Ramaphosa hasn't made himself more secure with the radical faction of the ANC, and if anything, they hate him more than ever. So you kind of wonder, well, what was the point of all of this?
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, from speech after speech, since his elevation in 2018, I think, was it 2018? My goodness, it's a lot of time that's gone by.
7 years.
And so little has really been done. It suggests a man who's really a sentimentalist. I mean, even his comment about, you know, there not being any magic, that he terribly regrets essentially sentimental condition of his relationship with John Steenhuisen. And yet there they are. I mean, there's the potential to build something that could very significantly benefit the ANC, and he just doesn't seem to see it. He doesn't seem to see that, you know, the leadership challenge at this point is to do something for the country. That's what will make an impression with voters, a good one anyway. But failing to do that, the voters are also keeping tabs on who's doing what and who isn't you know, bothering to come to the party. The voters, you know, I think all the polls have suggested that the country as a whole was really quite thankful that the political parties managed to come together and create something where they were supposedly going to be working towards the same thing. It was going to be growth. It was going to be jobs. We're going to, you know, reform, renew, all the rest of it, with things we've been hearing about. But unless it's actually delivered, it's just a shallow promise, an empty promise, yet another one. And that's not going to assist the ANC or Ramaphosa at all.
And we'll have to wait till the results of the next local government election to truly know what the verdict is on the ANC. But the early indications are that the country's verdict is not going to be a positive one. And I think that Ramaphosa, more so than any other, will only have himself to blame for that. Okay, let's move on to problems in the private public partnership sphere. So there's been this group of powerful business people who have been trying to help business government build capacity in a variety of areas called Business for South Africa. There's a variety of people involved in it. Two of the most famous are probably Adrian Gore and Neil Froneman. They've been looking at trying to capacitate government in various ways, providing them with forensic investigation skills to help with crime fighting and various other sort of efforts to improve government's technical capacity. And they've had a meeting recently where they've been talking about their successes and how they believe that there've been some improvements to the country. But there were some comments by Discovery CEO Adrian Gore that don't sit well with me. He said that some of his fellow business leaders were promoting an overly dark and corrosive narrative, which makes South Africa's crime problem appear worse than it really is. He said that progress has been made in improving electricity supply and stabilizing logistics, but exaggerated opinions on the severity of crime were a major challenge. Gore said, we have to expose more data. He said that a lot of the narrative and business leaders kind of muddy the water, and we are using a narrative that is not correct. So the crime data, the stuff that we faced at the White House, that is not correct. In fact, we are trying our best to get much more data and get granularity on the data. For example, we have seen a reduction in house breakings, hijackings, as being quite dramatic over the last number of years. And I think that's a countrywide phenomenon. Gore said the country was making more progress in fighting crime and corruption than many believed, and that this should be reflected in more accurate capturing of crime data. He said, we need to talk about it, measure it properly, and get it out there. I think dealing with the data properly in a proper, rational way will help us create a narrative that's much safer and secure. I think we are dealing with a very corrosive narrative in many cases that is not correct. I'm not sure who we should be arguing with business leaders. We can't muzzle people, but we need to show them the data that's accurate. So I don't know what data specifically Gore has access to that the public does not, that I do not. But I suspect that it is sort of missing the point. When it comes to things like hijackings, when it comes to things like house breakings, it's very difficult to collect accurate data, particularly when the police are not trusted. And in South Africa, the police are not trusted. When South Africans are asked about what parts of government they have the least faith in, the police almost always come out near the top. We don't know how much of the crime problems are underreported. And in fact, this is a well-known problem to many data analysts around the world who look at crime. And that's one of the reasons why when comparing between countries, or trying to get a sense of the sort of overall level of violence in a society, the murder rate is often used. Why? Because murders almost always get reported, even in dysfunctional systems. It's the one crime that the police usually do take extremely seriously. And so its stats are some of the most accurate. And when you look at our murder statistics, you find that South Africa continues to rank in the top 10 in the world in terms of murder rate, one of the highest of any country. A few years ago, we were, arguably higher than Haiti in terms of our murder rate per 100,000 people. Now, I mean, you can quibble with that, but the point is South Africa continues to have one of the highest levels of violent crime in the world. And you know, this, the way that Gore is sort of describing this, he's kind of blaming the country's lack of economic development on partly this negative atmosphere around crime. And he's talking a lot about narrative formation as though this is sort of, South Africa is just like a product to sell. It's like a used car. And if you just downplay the exhaust that doesn't sound very good, you know, you can get people to buy the product. And I think that's completely the wrong approach. You know, are there people who get over the top about South Africa's crime problems? Yeah, there are. But the reality is we have a very serious crime problem. And you can say, yes, there's been a decrease here or there. But the reality is, and we can all use anecdotes from our own lives, and I'm sure Gore has anecdotes to the contrary, the crime problem here is not getting better. And it's both data and anecdote, I think, that support that point of view. Michael, what do you take on all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm certainly conscious of, I'm sure we all are, of a what you could describe as a dark and corrosive pessimism that is out there. People who are just congenitally pessimistic and can't see anything improving and don't see anything good in anything that happens. There is that. But I think by and large, we are a remarkably optimistic and resilient society in the face of things which are very, very worrying. And the murder rate is one, and the very small or low faith in the police is a very, very worrying indicator of something that is amiss. If anything's going to be stimulating pessimism, it's going to be that. It's going to be the sense among ordinary people that they are vulnerable. Women especially, but not only women. If you're on your own, you're out in the society, if you're a business owner and you're going to a site in a region where where some kind of construction mafia or any other mafia is active or gangs are active, you're going to be at risk, you're going to feel vulnerable. If you're an MP going on a site visit to some place in the Cape Flats, you're vulnerable, as we saw recently. You're vulnerable in every possible context in South Africa, and we all know that. That is a source of constant worry in all households. It's not a narrative. It's not a dark and corrosive fable that's being generated by nefarious sources. It's simply people looking at the environment they're living in and making calculations about how safe they are or how unsafe. And if anything is going to turn that around, it's going to be evidence of organizations like Business Unity South Africa working with the police to overcome very particular things, to achieve benchmarks and say, this is what we, you know, and not to speculate about where the data is or what the numbers are. Let's just, before you say anything about it, look at the figures and interpret them and come out and say, well, this is what we think we need to look at, and this is how we get to do it. And we have a 6-month plan. And we're going to tackle it. We're not going to tolerate in a society that is prone to the kind of criminal vulnerability that South Africa is prone to. And that, as you say, Nicholas, is so vividly reflected in the loss of life to murderous criminals. I mean, it's as simple as that. So, yeah.
I also think, you know, he sort of also slipped the fight against corruption stuff in there as well. And I think that's just so ridiculous. As to not even really be worth examining properly. And to demonstrate that, let's talk about our next story, which is that the Special Investigating Unit has revealed how much money it believes has been stolen over the past couple of years from Tembisa Hospital. That is one hospital in Gauteng. Now, Tembisa Hospital was in the spotlight because the now murdered whistleblower, Babita Deokran, blew the whistle on the amount of money that was being stolen from Tembisa Hospital and was murdered for it. The people who are, you know, while there have been arrests made of the people who pulled the trigger, the people who organized the hit do not appear to have been brought to justice. And the Special Investigative Unit says that it has identified 7 extraction syndicates that extracted more than 2 billion rand from Tembisa Hospital. The Mamulela Syndicate banked 816 million rand. The Mazibuko Syndicate extracted 283 million rand. Tombi Syndicate or Syndicate X extracted another 596 million rand at least. It's just sort of crazy numbers. of just fraud, and this was all through inflated purchasing offers. I remember when the scale of corruption at Tembisa Hospital first came to light, I believe there was a story about the hospital buying jeans for some ridiculously inflated price. And, you know, the human cost is real. Not only was a woman murdered for trying to expose this corruption, but every old gogo who was not able to get the care that they needed, every person who had to go on an unnecessarily waiting list and either suffered or possibly died as a result of there just not being the resources at that hospital, it's because of this corruption. And it is, I think, just an indictment, not just of the sort of the state, but also this idea that through the national health insurance, the government should in fact collect all of our money to spend it. In fact, defenders of the NHI will even say, well, you know, corruption like this is exactly why we government should collect all the spending into one big pile so that we can keep a closer watch on it. Well, you know, fool me once kind of thing. That doesn't really convince me. As we've seen from other national pots of money, they have not gone unplundered. Michael, what's your take on this story?
Yeah, when you were just building up to revealing the sum that was involved here, I was reminded of the sort of castigation that was often leveled at the media and the newspapers that I worked for many years, when some major story would break and there'd be a sort of huge headline, very dramatic and so on, and somebody would say, you're sensationalizing X, Y, and Z. And the most obvious answer always is there is no way that you can sensationalize this. It is already so sensational. And in a way, we need to remind ourselves that it is sensational. I mean, it is absolutely staggering. There was a time, I think, when if somebody mentioned a 200,000 rand corruption saga, you know, perhaps in 1998, it would have been a front page lead. You know, if we're now looking at 2 billion. It's shameless. From one hospital. I mean, it is just staggering. And this again, you know, it comes back to all the themes that we've been talking about this afternoon. The lack of consequences, the seeming lack of seriousness about, you know, just having meetings to sort things out. It's worrying about narratives and dark and mysterious things that are being said about crime. Well, you know, here's something that is deeply sensational and deeply worrying. And there needs to be a very clear indication of what's being done about it if the society is to have any optimism that that we have a way of getting out of this kind of mess. It's just not playable, you know, so we can't afford it. And as you say, Nicholas, this thing, I remember Marius, our former colleague of ours, often bringing this point home, that in every instance of this kind of thing, waste of money, joblessness, figures, GDP growth, it comes down to a human life. There's a human consequence. Somebody not being treated properly, somebody dying or not, you know, not recovering from an awful disease, not being able to be fixed because there isn't the money or there isn't the proper equipment or whatever the case might be. So a very, very profound human cost to these sorts of lapses, failures.
I know people who were not in Tembisa Hospital, but who were in state hospitals, who didn't get the care they needed. And I don't know if it was the sort of whether it was a kind of deliberate thing or just the resources were stretched too thin. I mean, the people I'm thinking of were not healthy. So you can understand why doctors would prioritize scarce resources to helping others. But, you know, those people died. And one of the reasons that they died in the grand scheme of things was because the money that should have been available for their care was siphoned off to pay for ill-gotten gains of luxury cars or fancy houses or some politically connected person.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is genuinely a cost in human lives. It is not just a sum of money. It's not just the taxpayer being robbed. And I think that's the thing we need to keep in mind.
Yeah. The other thing I think it's always worth mentioning is this also comes at a very great cost to the very great number of excellent people in state hospitals, in clinics, who are trying their very best against the odds, who are, you know, hanging in there and very kind of bravely, courageously going on with their jobs. And they are also being failed terribly by exactly this kind of abuse. Yeah.
Okay, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found this show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day. Goodbye. The Daily Friend Show and the Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.